KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
From New York, this is Democracy Now!
2 hours ago, colleagues, I asked Mr. Kennedy to reconcile his many anti-vaccine statements with his handful of pro-vaccine statements. Instead, he gave us a word salad and ducked the issue.
During a confirmation hearing Wednesday, Senate Democrats grilled Robert F. Kennedy Jr., President Trump's pick to head the Department of Health and Human Services. We'll speak to Oregon Senator Ron Wyden, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, about Kennedy. Also, today's confirmation hearing for Tulsi Gabbard, Trump's pick to be Director of National Intelligence, as well as the Trump administration's shocking reversal under enormous pressure to freeze all federal grants and loans. Plus, we get the latest from Washington after an American airline carrying 64 people collided with an Army helicopter near Reagan National Airport. No one is believed to have survived. Then to Gaza, where Hamas has released 8 more hostages. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Rescue workers in Washington, D.C. have launched a massive search operation in the Potomac after an American Airlines flight and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter collided midair late Wednesday, with both aircrafts crashing into the river. So far, no survivors have been found. At least 30 bodies have been pulled from the river. American Airlines Flight 5342 had 60 passengers and 4 crew members on board and was en route to the D.C. area, Reagan National Airport, from Wichita, Kansas. Several passengers were members of U.S. figure skating who were heading home after a training camp and the Nationals. The Black Hawk helicopter had 3 soldiers on board conducting a training flight. An investigation is underway by the National Transportation Safety Board, aided by the Federal Aviation Administration. On social media, President Trump called the crash, quote, a bad situation that looks like it should have been prevented, unquote. Just 1 week prior to Wednesday's deadly crash, Trump fired the head of the Transportation Security Administration and all members of the Aviation Security Advisory Committee. The crash comes just days after the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Whitaker, stepped down. FAA administrators usually serve 5-year terms. Trump has not named a replacement. Whitaker announced his planned departure in December after Elon Musk repeatedly attacked him on social media, tweeting, "He needs to resign." The White House Wednesday rescinded a memo from the Office of Management and Budget that briefly froze trillions of dollars of federal grants and loans, even though the money had already been appropriated by Congress. The order set off panic and mass confusion across the federal bureaucracy, briefly disrupting funding for Medicaid, housing, and other public services Tuesday before a federal judge put a temporary hold on the plan. On Wednesday, a second federal judge, U.S. District Judge Jack McConnell in Rhode Island, signaled he, too, would block the Trump administration from withholding federal disbursements, writing, quote, "I am very concerned about the irreparable harm which has clearly been put forth," he said. On Wednesday, Press Secretary Karoline Leavitt insisted the reversal was not a rescission of the federal funding freeze and said the White House would continue to seek ways to eliminate funding for what it called woke ideologies. President Trump has signed the Laken Riley Act into law, which allows federal immigration authorities to indefinitely detain undocumented immigrants arrested for certain nonviolent crimes without due process. 46 Democrats from the House, 12 from the Senate, joined their Republican colleagues in voting in favor. At the signing ceremony for the first piece of legislation of a second term, President Trump announced plans to send, quote, the worst criminal aliens to Guantanamo Bay. The military was reportedly unaware of Trump's plan, which would require new infrastructure to house up to 30,000 people. Cuban Foreign Minister Bruno Rodriguez said, quote, the U.S. government's decision to imprison migrants at the Guantanamo Naval Base in an enclave where it created torture and indefinite detention centers shows contempt for the human condition and international law, he said. Meanwhile, deportation flights to Latin America are continuing amidst Trump's escalating crackdown. Recently deported Guatemalans say the crackdown has targeted everyone in the immigrant community.
Trump said that he was only going to catch the criminals, but now the police are also collaborating with immigration. So if you are driving and there are two or three people in the car, they will get caught even if they are not criminals. They're taking everyone.
I left two children there, and now I'm here in Guatemala. I don't know how I can get them back. They took me away from my children. It's tough to live because I am a mother. I can't live without my children.
At least four U.S. military planes carrying deported people landed in Guatemala this week following Colombia's refusal to accept military deportation flights. Colombia instead sent its own aircraft to fly deportees home with dignity, they said. In more immigration news, Trump officials have rescinded the Biden administration's 18-month extension of TPS. That's temporary protected status for over 600,000 Venezuelans. The order means those affected only have protection under TPS until April and September of this year. The Senate has confirmed former Long Island Republican Congressman Lee Zeldin as head of the Environmental Protection Agency. Three Democrats sided with Republicans in Wednesday's vote to confirm Zeldin. Arizona Senators Ruben Gallego and Mark Kelly and Pennsylvania Senator John Fetterman. The Youth Climate Action Group Sunrise Movement condemns Zeldin's confirmation as a disaster for the planet and a win for fossil fuel executives, writing, quote, he took $420,000 from Big Oil, pledged to undo climate protections, and has been all in with Trump backing corporate polluters at the expense of working people, they said. Meanwhile, Democratic senators grilled Health and Human Services nominee RFK Jr. at his confirmation hearing Wednesday. We'll have more on the confirmation hearings for Robert F. Kennedy Jr. with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. Also on Wednesday, senators advanced nominations of Pam Bondi for attorney general and Kelly Loeffler to head the Small Business Administration. Meanwhile, Trump's nominee for director of national intelligence, former Hawaii Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard, faces an uphill battle to confirmation when she appears before the Senate Intelligence Committee today. Fox News reports Gabbard does not currently have a majority of the votes needed, with half of the committee's Republicans still undecided. We'll also discuss Gabbard with Oregon Senator Ron Wyden. Israel scheduled to free 110 Palestinians, including 30 children, from its prisons after Hamas said it had released three Israelis and five Thai nationals held hostage in Gaza since October 7, 2023. The exchange took place as Trump's Middle East envoy, the former head of the Inauguration Committee, Steve Witkoff, arrived in Israel and became the first senior American official to enter Gaza in nearly 15 years. Witkoff toured the Israeli-occupied Netzarim corridor separating northern and southern Gaza, embedded among Israeli soldiers. On Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said he'd accepted President Trump's invitation to meet at the White House next Tuesday. Also Wednesday, Trump signed an executive order to deport non-citizen college students and other international visitors who take part in pro-Palestinian protests. Trump said in a statement accompanying the order, quote, I will quickly cancel the student visas of all Hamas sympathizers on college campuses, which have been infested with radicalism like never before, Trump said. In Gaza, Israeli airstrikes have killed two Palestinians despite the ceasefire agreement. Separately, an Israeli civilian contractor working with Israel's military in Gaza was shot dead by Israeli soldiers, apparently after being mistaken for a Palestinian. In the occupied West Bank, an Israeli airstrike on the Palestinian town of Tamun late Wednesday killed 10 people and left several other Palestinians wounded. The attack came as Israel's army arrested 26 Palestinians in raids across the occupied West Bank. Separately, Israeli warplanes have fired two missiles at a building in Jenin refugee camp earlier today. On Wednesday, Israeli Defense Minister Israel Katz said Israeli forces will remain in the Jenin refugee camp and will continue to occupy additional territory it recently seized in Syria's Golan Heights. This all comes as international staff working for the UN's Agency for Palestinian Refugees, UNRWA, have been forced to leave their posts after Israel's ban on the agency came into effect earlier today. UNRWA spokesperson Jonathan Fowler said Israel's decision could trigger a collapse of humanitarian aid to Palestinians.
In East Jerusalem, we serve 70,000 patients who are at the sort of bottom of the economic ladder, the most vulnerable members of society, people who don't have access to affordable healthcare alternatives and use our free healthcare system. These people need us. They need these services. It's like a nightmare scenario, and it's also completely outlandish.
A federal judge in Manhattan has sentenced former New Jersey Democratic Senator Bob Menendez to 11 years in prison following his conviction on corruption charges. In July, jurors found Menendez guilty of bribery, wire fraud, extortion, obstruction of justice, conspiracy, and acting as a foreign agent for Egypt. He's due to report to prison June 6. Menendez spoke to reporters following his sentencing Wednesday, stoking speculation he's seeking a pardon from President Trump.
Welcome to the Southern District of New York, the Wild West of political prosecutions. President Trump is right. This process is political and it's corrupted to the core. I hope President Trump cleans up the cesspool and restores the integrity to the system.
And the Justice Department is reportedly in talks with federal prosecutors in Manhattan about dropping corruption charges against New York City Mayor Eric Adams. Adams was indicted last year on 5 counts, including bribery, conspiracy, and campaign finance violations. A growing number of Adams' allies have also been indicted or resigned. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman.
And I'm Nermeen Sheikh. Welcome to our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world. President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., appeared before the Senate Finance Committee on Wednesday. The confirmation hearing was repeatedly interrupted by protesters criticizing Kennedy's long record of vaccine skepticism. Kennedy is a former environmental attorney who went on to lead Children's Health Defense, a nonprofit that's filed more than 30 lawsuits challenging vaccine and other public health mandates. Kennedy is the son of former Attorney General Robert F. Kennedy and the nephew of President John F. Kennedy. Ahead of the hearing, JFK's daughter, Ambassador Carolyn Kennedy, called on senators to reject her cousin, who she described as a predator and dangerous. Supporters of Kennedy see him as a leading figure in the so-called Make America Healthy Again movement. If confirmed to head HHS, Kennedy would oversee numerous agencies, including the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, and the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services.
In a moment, we'll be joined by Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon, the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee. But first, let's turn to Senator Wyden questioning Robert F. Kennedy Jr. on Wednesday.
Mr. Kennedy, you have spent years pushing conflicting stories about vaccines. You say one thing and then you say another. In your testimony today under oath, you denied that you were anti-vaccine. But during a podcast interview in July of 2023, you said, quote, no vaccine is safe and effective. In your testimony today, in order to prove you're not anti-vax, you note that all your kids are vaccinated. But in a podcast in 2020, you said, and I quote, you would do anything, pay anything to go back in time and not vaccinate your kids. Mr. Kennedy, all of these things cannot be true. So, are you lying to Congress today when you say you are pro-vaccine? Or did you lie on all those podcasts? We have all of this on tape, by the way.
Yeah, Senator, as you know, because it's been repeatedly debunked, that statement that I made on the Lex Fridman podcast was a fragment of the statement. He asked me, and anybody who actually goes and looks at that podcast and we'll see this. He asked me, are there vaccines that are safe and effective? And I said to him, some of the live virus vaccines are. And I said, there are no vaccines that are safe and effective. And I was going to continue for every person. Every medicine has people who are sensitive to them, including vaccines.
Right. So
he interrupted me at that point. I've corrected it many times, including on national TV. You know about this, Senator Wyden. So bringing this up right now is dishonest.
Let's be clear about what you've actually done then, since you want to deny your statements. For example, you have a history of trying to take vaccines away from people. In May of 2021, you petitioned the Food and Drug Administration to not only block Americans from having access to the COVID vaccine, but to prevent any future access to the life-saving vaccine. Are you denying that? Your name is on the petition.
We brought that petition after CDC recommended the COVID vaccine without any scientific basis for six-year-old children. Most experts agree today, even the people who did it back then, that COVID vaccines are inappropriate for six-year-old children who basically have a zero risk from COVID. That's why I brought that lawsuit. I don't want to. I want to emphasize
this. Mr. Kennedy, the facts. The facts.
That was Democratic Senator Ron Wyden from Oregon. He's the ranking member of the Senate Finance Committee, questioning President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., when he appeared before the committee on Wednesday. That was a brief interruption by a protester. Senator Wyden is joining us now from the Russell Rotunda in the Senate office building. He also has a new book just out. It's called It Takes Chutzpah, How to Fight Fearlessly for Progressive Change. Senator, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. If you can start off by just talking about the significance of Robert F. Kennedy Jr. Heading up Health and Human Services, in charge of NIH, in charge of the Centers for Disease Control, agencies that he has long fiercely criticized.
Amy, this is one of the most important positions in the world as it relates to healthcare, because a lot of the decisions we make on medicines and therapies are copied around the world. And I was listening to what you played, and what you heard was vintage Robert Kennedy double talk. You know, he has tried so hard to be anti-vax, and again and again and again, he belongs to organizations, he makes statements and the like. Now he desperately wants this appointment from Donald Trump, so he is trying to pretend that he's pro-vax. I think the reality is that he cannot be trusted, number one, and he's unprepared. And the reason I say unprepared is it was clear yesterday he didn't even understand the Medicaid program. He thought that there were premiums involved, and it was clear that he just didn't understand the architecture of the programs he would run if confirmed.
Senator Wyden, you've said that he's, quote, embraced conspiracy theories, quacks, and charlatans on vaccine safety and efficacy. What is your assessment on the line of questioning yesterday? Were you satisfied with the number of questions you were able to ask and others were able to ask? And what remains?
I believe my Democratic colleagues were outstanding. They went at all of the issues where he had made these very outlandish statements. He pretends that he didn't. A number of my colleagues looked at the financial links that he benefits from when he's doing all this anti-vax activity. I think that we put on the kind of hearing on our side that puts him on the precipice where possibly he will not be confirmed.
You have his fierce criticism of vaccines and surprised many, probably, when he said he was not anti-vaccine. But he also has fierce criticism of the agriculture industry, the power of the drug industry. Can you comment on that, where you actually agree with him and where you don't?
Certainly when he talks about tobacco cessation, I was the one who blew the whistle on the tobacco executives lying about the addictiveness of nicotine. I certainly share views with them on matters like that. But on the big, crucial kinds of questions, for example, this COVID petition, you know, that would have made it impossible to get out the services that were so needed while we were in the eye of the storm. And his policies, I think, are going to leave Americans sicker.
Senator Wyden, we'd also like to ask you about the White House Budget Office's decision to rescind an order to freeze trillions of dollars of federal grants and loans. The initial order from Matthew Waith, the acting director of the White House Office of Management and Budget, set off chaos around the country as funding for critical programs, including Medicaid, Head Start, Meals on Wheels, and many others appear to be in jeopardy. The OMB rescinded the memo after a federal judge in Washington, D.C. temporarily halted the radical plan. This all comes as Trump has nominated the architect of Project 2025, Russell Vogt, to head the OMB. During his recent confirmation hearing, Vogt was questioned by our guest, by you, Democratic Senator Ron Wyden of Oregon.
I think the distillation of the Trump economic program is to give tax breaks to all the people at the top, and it's going to be paid for by these kinds of cuts in efficient health care programs like Medicaid and hunger programs and the like. And I'd like to know, does that concern you at all, that we have these values that are going to help the people right at the top, at the tippy top of the top, and we're going to cut these programs like Medicaid and hunger? Are those your values? Do you think that that's something that is in line with American values? Because I think we want everybody to have a chance to get ahead.
Senator, I fully support the notion that we want everyone to get ahead, and we would not characterize our economic program that way. We think it's important to give people tax cuts at all levels. The president wants to extend those tax cuts.
But what about the vulnerable people who are going to get hurt in the process?
So that was Democratic Senator Ron Wyden questioning OMB nominee Russell Vogt. I mean, total chaos this week. You have the President Trump proposing to cut trillions of dollars from programs to the neediest Americans. And then, because of enormous outcry, he pulls back. And you are leading the charge, Senator Wyden, to call for a postponement of the vote on Russell Vogt to be the head of OMB. Can you talk about him as one of the key architects of Project 2025 and what that is and why you're calling for this delay?
There is no question in my mind that this is a person who has got a laser target out there for Medicaid. Medicaid, of course, is a lifeline for millions of people. And in fact, one of the things that was good this week that happened is when we heard that Donald Trump was going to cause bedlam in the Medicaid portals, the activists who are supportive of Medicaid got in touch with me. I put it online, and all over America, so many people spoke out against Trump's efforts to cause harm to Medicaid. We blocked it within 12 hours. So we're going to be all in this fight, and Russell Vogt is the architect of it. The Project 2025 effort features a number of key kinds of questions, but this is his big victory that he wants to accomplish.
So what do you accomplish by postponing the vote?
What we do is we give a chance for more people to see what's at stake. It's kind of like, you know, Donald Trump has consistently not paid the bills that he owed when he was in the private sector. So a judge basically caught up with him, and that's how we helped to block the freeze. We're going to get the word out, just as I did when the Medicaid portals were closed down there for a few hours. What happened was those activists and those whistleblowers got in touch with me. I put it out all across the country. The credit deserves to go to the whistleblowers who brought it to us. We get additional time. We can block these cuts too.
And Senator Ron Wyden, could you also comment on the confirmation hearing forthcoming for Tulsi Gabbard to become Director of National Intelligence? You've worked with her in the past on privacy legislation, but you've expressed some concerns about her potentially occupying this position. If you could elaborate.
I'd like to find out what her current positions are on matters like the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, which is a hugely important issue. At one time, she was against it. Now she seems that she may be for it. I'm also very concerned about Americans being swept up in these searches. So we're going to get to the bottom of what her positions actually are. And clearly, the Trump people have been lobbying her hard.
If you could talk more about that, because Senator Wyden, you are known as a leader on challenging these FISA courts. For those who aren't so familiar, we have a global audience. Explain your deep concerns, how she agreed with you as a Congress member, and then what exactly how she's turned around.
Well, what I think she was concerned about was law-abiding Americans getting swept up in the warrant process. And I have led that effort, and I'm sure we'll talk about that today. But I think on top of that, she is concerned that civil liberties are just getting the short shrift. You know, I believe that security and liberty are not mutually exclusive. You can have both. You can have your freedoms and have security. I think she said that in the past. The question is, will she say it again today?
Senator Wyden, could we also ask you about, you've commented on this, the fact that at the Trump's inauguration, there were all of the leading tech CEOs, from Zuckerberg to Sundar Pichai, and of course Elon Musk, who is now formerly a member of Trump's administration. You've done a great deal of work on tech. What are your concerns about the proximity of these tech CEOs to the Trump administration?
Well, it clearly sent a message that his real friends, his real allies, are the billionaires. Let me tell your listeners, though, I think that what Mark Zuckerberg did, toadying up to Trump here recently and saying he'd give up his fact checkers, was just god-awful. And I think what it does is it sends a message to all the big tech companies, hey, you can do what I did, maybe line up a favor in the future with Donald Trump, and we can reconsolidate big media the way it was before the internet.
I wanted to go back to our headlines, Senator Wyden, to our first story, of course, this horrendous crash, mid-air crash over the Potomac between a Black Hawk helicopter and this American Airlines flight. It looks like there are absolutely no survivors. At least 30 bodies have been pulled. It's American Airlines. The crash coming just days after the head of the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Whitaker, stepped down. Now, this is extremely significant. FAA administrators usually serve five-year terms. Trump has not named a replacement. Whitaker announced his planned departure in December after SpaceX CEO and Trump donor Elon Musk repeatedly attacked him on social media, attacked Whitaker, saying he needs to resign. I mean, on the one hand, the power of the richest man on earth working with Trump, and we don't know what happened here. We cannot say why they crashed. It is so rare to have this kind of collision. Horrific. But if you can comment on this.
Well, I'm certainly concerned about the Trump administration's policies as it relates to ensuring that we have adequate personnel to prevent this. This is such a horrifying story that we have gotten this morning, the tragic loss of life. And I will tell you, there are going to be a host of questions. One of the first that I asked myself this morning is, what was that DOD helicopter doing in that particular place? And so we've got to make sure that we have the adequate personnel to prevent this in the future and get to the bottom of what these decisions in terms of the Trump personnel in the last few weeks have meant.
We know you have to go in just about a minute. You've got the Tulsi Gabbard hearing coming up. But we did want to ask you about your new book, A Take Chutzpah. And the subtitle is How to Fight Fearlessly for Progressive Change. Many are questioning, where is the Democratic Party today? Where is the response to the enormous, what many people would say might be the majority of people in this country, progressive base, but just not being responded to by the Democratic Democratic Party. Can you talk about what takes chutzpah and how you think chutzpah needs to be a center, an underpinning of the movement today?
Chutzpah is about nerve. It's about grit. It's about taking on long odds. And my chutzpah winners of the week are all those wonderful people that helped us get the Trump effort to block the Medicaid portals turned around. You know, when he did it, he didn't think there would necessarily be any mobilization. We got out there early. The whistleblowers did their job. That was a tremendous victory for grassroots involvement to protect health care for low-income people. That's chutzpah to do that kind of thing. Mm.
Well, Ron Wyden, I want to thank you for being with us. Longtime Democratic senator from Oregon, his new book, It Takes Chutzpah, How to Fight Fearlessly for Progressive Change. When we come back, we'll get the latest from Washington after this airline carrying 64 people, many young skaters coming back from the Nationals in a training camp in Wichita, collides with an Army Black Hawk helicopter near Reagan National Airport. No one is believed to have survived. We'll speak with the Lever's David Sirota, and then we'll go to the Middle East. Stay with us. Senses Working Overtime by Ecstasy. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Rescue workers in Washington, D.C. have launched a massive search operation in the Potomac River after an American Airlines flight and a U.S. Army Black Hawk helicopter collided mid-air late Wednesday, with both aircraft crashing into the water. Officials say there are likely no survivors. At least 30 bodies have been pulled from the river. American Airlines Flight 5342 had 60 passengers and four crew members on board and was en route to the D.C. area Reagan National Airport from Wichita, Kansas. The Black Hawk helicopter had three soldiers on board conducting a training flight. The National Transportation Safety Board will investigate with the Federal Aviation Administration.
The crash comes just days after the head of the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, Mike Whitaker, stepped down. FAA administrators usually serve five-year terms. Trump has not named a replacement. Whitaker announced his planned departure in December after SpaceX CEO, Trump donor, richest man in the world, Elon Musk, repeatedly attacked him on social media, tweeting, "He needs to resign." Musk was responding to $600,000 in FAA fines against SpaceX for safety violations along Florida's Space Coast. For more, we're joined by David Sirota, editor-in-chief of The Lever, which has a new report headlined, "Before D.C. Airport Collision, Lawmakers Brushed Off Warnings and Boosted Flights." Welcome back to Democracy Now!, David. You know, this story is so horrific. I know the skating community well. My sister-in-law was almost in the Olympics as a skater, her mother a coach. The horror that many on the flight were young ones who were training for ultimately to go into the Olympics, their families waiting at Reagan Airport. The American Airlines flight, taking them back from Wichita training camp after the Nationals, collides with an Army Black Hawk helicopter. They say it was a training flight. Can you talk about this piece that you wrote, "Despite mid-flight near misses and dire pleas, airline bankrolled lawmakers recently expanded flight traffic at Washington's busy airport. David, I just watched the news briefing. There was the two Virginia senators who objected to this expansion, right? Tim Kaine, as well as Senator Warner. They didn't mention that this morning, but if you can talk all about it, give us some background.
Sure. So Washington National Airport is a relatively small airport and one of the busiest, if not the busiest airport in the country because of how close it is to the center of Washington, D.C., the city there. For years, there has been a debate about whether to expand the amount of flights that can go into Washington Reagan Airport. And over the course of a few decades, there has been a steady increase in the number of slots, that is to say, the amount of traffic at Washington National Airport, air traffic. And just a few months ago, as we reported, that debate over how much to expand Washington National hit a fever pitch in Congress. There's been a push by a set of airlines to expand those flights. There's some other airlines that don't want to expand those flights because they're already controlling those routes. So there's a sort of an economic battle going on, who gets to control what routes. But at the core of it, according to opponents of this, including the senators that you mentioned, there is a very deep safety concern at this airport because there had been a series of near misses, near collisions at the airport because it is so heavily trafficked. So a few months ago, put into the FAA authorization bill was some language that further expanded these slots and also the perimeter. That's the length of the flights that are allowed to come into Washington National. Basically, this is the opponents argue this is Congress people from cities farther away from Washington want more direct flights into Washington because it's more convenient for them. That's the opponent's argument. But again, at the core is the safety question. There have been real safety concerns, again, about these near misses at this particular airport. And so a few months ago, that language was slipped into the FAA reauthorization bill, which further expanded the traffic. And it should be said, when it actually came up for a vote in the House in 2023, the House voted it down. So there were some legislative machinations here in which the proponents of this had to slip it into a larger bill, kind of stealthily, to get this expansion passed. And Tim Kaine said he was very concerned about the prospect of collisions at this airport, begging lawmakers to not do this.
And could you talk, David Sirota, about the significance of the fact that the collision occurred with a Black Hawk helicopter?
Yeah, sure. Well, look, we don't know the exactly what happened and what is at issue here with an alleged training flight of helicopters. But I think it's worth saying this. If you've ever been near or flown into Washington National Airport, you can see it's some of the most heavily trafficked airspace in the world, including by the military. So I think what we're talking about here is whether an airport that is already so stressed, already so at capacity, arguably over capacity, whether it should have been the air traffic should have been expanded, knowing, again, it's also additional special circumstance of being around so much additional air traffic vis-a-vis the military.
And this whole idea of who is in charge of the military flights, I mean, this is unusual at this airport as opposed to all others. I was talking to someone who's saying that pilots actually most fear this airport. It's one of the most dangerous in the country, where you have all these Black Hawk helicopters and they take military officials and other officials. And then you've got all the civilian flights that they keep increasing. How much do they communicate with each other, David?
Yeah, that's a great question, and I have seen some reporting saying that the radar wasn't communicating on this training flight. I'm not sure that's been substantiated. So I'm not trying to put out misinformation
right.
or disinformation.
These are just the questions.
It's only to say that again. This particular space, this airspace, has been a known safety hazard for a very long time, and certain airlines spend money on lobbying Congress and campaign contributions to key members of Congress have been pushing to expand the amount of flights into this particular airport. And again, I just want to say one other thing here. This is a city that is served by a much larger airport farther out of the city, Dulles Airport. And so the argument has been, listen, we should not expand the amount of flights going into Washington Reagan, even though it's more convenient for passengers when you get off the plane because it's closer to the city, because we have a larger airport a little bit further away. So the argument was, again, this is members of Congress who want, for their convenience, to fly to the closest airport to their office. And the argument was that they were listening to their airline donors. They were listening to their desire for their own convenience, not listening to the multiple safety warnings about this airport.
And let's remember, it's called now Reagan National Airport, used to be National Airport, known for President Reagan. And President Reagan is known for breaking up the PATCO union, the Air Traffic Controllers Union, back in the 1980s.
Absolutely. And there's a question, there's been questions, and I don't know if it's germane to what happened in this disaster, but there have been questions about air traffic control resources, understaffing, the current staff being essentially overworked. All of these questions have been swirling for years. And so our job at The Lever, what we do is we look back at the decisions that were made in the lead up to situations like this. And again, these warnings about expanding the flight traffic at this airport came just a few months ago. I mean, if you go read our story, you will see legislators warning, really dire pleas to not expand the amount of traffic at this airport.
David Sirota, you are editor-in-chief of The Lever. You are following what's happening in Washington extremely closely. To say the least, we're talking about everything, everywhere, all at once. With the President Trump's inauguration and the number of executive orders, the number of hearings for his nominees to be in his cabinet. But you also have a massive amount of pushback. If you can talk about what just took place, the significance, and just your take over the last 10 days, but the significance of cutting trillions of dollars, or so-called pausing them, putting them on hold, and then because of the outcry, again, this hurting people, veterans, this hurting families in need, heating, housing assistance, Meals on Wheels, Head Start. And suddenly, after the chaos of just a number of hours, the Trump administration almost says, sorry, only kidding.
Yeah, I mean, this is really unprecedented. And I say that having worked in the U.S. House Appropriations Committee back during and after 9/11. So I worked in the committees that dealt with the spending in this country, the budget in this country. And I have never seen, I had, following it since then, had never seen something this brazen. Now, to be clear, the fight over the spending issue has been something that has happened in the distant past. Richard Nixon tried to so-called impound, that's holding back money appropriated by Congress. He tried to do that in the 70s. Congress passed a very explicit law saying, no, you actually cannot do this. Ronald Reagan explored doing this. John Roberts, by the way, as we reported, sent a memo when he was working in the Reagan administration saying essentially the president does not have the power to unilaterally withhold spending authorized by Congress and enshrined in law.
Chief Justice of the United States.
That's right. And John Roberts would, if this kind of thing comes to the court, the Supreme Court, John Roberts would be weighing in on this. Look, this is unprecedented. Donald Trump effectively tried to unilaterally repeal the federal government by fiat, and he was rejected essentially by the American people. He was rejected temporarily by a court. And what I would say is it is a warning about what is coming, that while the reversal happened very quickly because of the outcry, because of the mass chaos that it sowed. That chaos here is the goal, chaos in service of Trump grabbing more power for himself. If he was successful in this, and he will try it again, what he will essentially do is render the legislature powerless. He will essentially eliminate the authority of one of the branches of the U.S. government, the checks and balances, the most democratic branch. And the last thing I'll say here, Amy, which is really important, especially when it comes to spending, the reason the founders put the power of the purse in the power of the Congress, and specifically in the power of the House, is because the House is and the Congress are the most small d democratic parts of the government, the parts of the government that are supposed to be most responsive to the people. So the president trying to take away that power of the purse is a direct assault on the founding principles that spending decisions are made by the most democratic parts of our government.
David Sirota, we want to thank you so much for being with us, editor-in-chief of The Lever. He has a new report headlined, Before D.C. Airport Collision, Lawmakers Brushed Off Warnings and Boosted Flights. We'll link to it at democracynow.org. Coming up, we look at Gaza as Hamas releases 8 more hostages. Netanyahu planning to come to the White House next week to meet with President Trump, the first foreign leader to meet with President Trump at the White House. Stay with us. بعد ما نسي بعد الحجر قاعد صافا نفس السماء بعد ما قسي بعد البحر شارد حامل كل السفن بعد ما رسي بعد في ذكرى بالقلب محمولة فيها بقى يا رمشي خصلة شعر بتفي كل Mints of Memory by Faraj Suleiman. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
Israel is scheduled to free 110 Palestinians, including 30 children, from its prisons after Hamas released 3 Israelis and 5 Thai nationals held hostage in Gaza since October 7, 2023. The exchange took place as Trump's Middle East envoy, Steve Witkoff, arrived in Israel and became the first senior American official to enter Gaza in nearly 15 years. Witkoff toured the Israeli-occupied Netzarim corridor separating northern and southern Gaza, embedded among Israeli soldiers. Witkoff is also meeting today with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, who's scheduled to visit Trump at the White House next week. Netanyahu's trip comes just 2 months after the International Criminal Court issued an arrest warrant for Netanyahu.
We're joined right now by Mohammed Shahada, writer and analyst from Gaza. He's chief of communications at Euro-Mediterranean Human Rights Monitor, joining us from Copenhagen. Mohammed, welcome back to Democracy Now! Can you talk about what unfolded today in Gaza, and as of the time of this broadcast, what is expected to unfold when it comes to the prisoners released by Israel, Palestinian prisoners?
Sure. Thanks for having me, Amy. So today, Hamas released an Israeli soldier that was captured from Nahal Oz, a Gamberger, in addition to 2 other civilian Israeli hostages that were released in Khan Yunis and 5 Thai workers. There's a significance in the way that the release was conducted. A Gamberger was released basically in Jabalia, an area that Israel has wiped out over a process of over 100 days of systematically destroying every single building in the city. Nothing is left standing. And in Khan Yunis, the other hostages were released right in front of Yahya Sinwar's house, also an area that Israel invaded, wiped out systematically, bombed indiscriminately. So in both, there is the attempt to say that Israel had no clue throughout these 15 months how to get the hostages out militarily, and the only way to get them out is through a ceasefire, which has been the position mediators has been reiterating for over 15 months. The other thing is that Netanyahu is trying desperately to use any loopholes in the agreement to collapse the ceasefire. We saw that last Saturday when he was supposed to open up the Netzarim corridor and allow people to go to northern Gaza, and he withdrew from that last minute, postponed it indefinitely until mediators pressured him, and it happened on Monday in return for hostages that were released today outside of the framework. Today, he's delaying and procrastinating the release of Palestinian captives and prisoners, citing that Hamas's release of one of the hostages or two in Khan Yunis was overcrowded and hostile to the hostages themselves. So he's demanding a safe passage, quote unquote, which in other words, as Israeli media is warning us every single day, Netanyahu is trying everything he could to sabotage the deal from this early on. This is why you had Steve Witkoff go to Gaza to see it with his own eyes yesterday before he even met with Netanyahu, to signify how little trust he has in the Israeli prime minister to see the progress of the ceasefire on the ground himself, and also to emphasize to Netanyahu that the deal has to be seen through.
And so, Mohammed, could you talk a little bit more about that, the significance of Witkoff's visit? He was in Saudi Arabia before he came to Israel. He's the first senior, as you said, U.S. official in years to actually go in to Gaza. And today he met with Netanyahu, but also with his far-right cabinet minister, finance minister, Smotrich. So, you know, what do you make of this and your assessment of his work on the ceasefire, a ceasefire agreement that was reached that the Biden administration failed to reach?
Thanks, Nermeen. Very good question. So basically with Witkoff, as you said, it's the first visit in over 15 years. The last time we had a similar visit was John Kerry when he was a U.S. senator in 2009, very brief, didn't even continue for over a day, so only border areas in Gaza and then left immediately. There was not even the pretense by any U.S. official ever since to want to see what's inside Gaza. So this is monumental in the sense that he broke a taboo that has been established for over a decade. The other thing is that with Witkoff's visit to Gaza, there's also, as you said, the meetings with far-right Israeli ministers. The parallel track that he's working on is the issue with transferring 1.5 million Gazans to neighboring countries. And Israeli media until last night have been saying that this is a dead serious topic that he's discussing seriously with Netanyahu and his ministers. At the same time, we got the pulse of different sources in Israel, like a cabinet minister who told the Times of Israel that this rhetoric about transferring Gazans outside might appease the Israeli far right and allow Netanyahu to carry on with the deal. It might give Israel the alternative victory image. They couldn't destroy Hamas militarily, but now they want to maintain Gaza as an uninhabitable territory to push people to leave. So that might give them this alternative victory image. But on the other side, you have Palestinians saying immediately, we're not going to leave no matter what. Israel tried that repeatedly. In 1951, that's when they first started trying to convince Egypt to take 12,000 Gazans and resettle them into Sinai. Gazans protested, dried it in an intifada in 55 and killed it. My own family were kicked out of Gaza in 67. To Egypt, and they were living there for about 27 years. They never forgot. They went back to Gaza as soon as there was an opportunity with the Oslo Accords. So it's not something that is gonna be workable for Trump to carry out. You have even people from his own camp, like senators, that are saying that this is unworkable, this is improbable.
Mohammed, also, you know, before we move to other issues, the significance of Trump inviting Netanyahu just as this is occurring next week to the White House.
Well, it has two significances. Number one is that the U.S. is signaling that international law is obsolete, that they tossed it into the garbage. The international rule-based order is no longer valid, because you have here someone with arrest warrants on his head by the International Criminal Court for crimes against humanity being honored in Washington, D.C., in the White House, the highest executive branch of government. At the same time, the other significance is Trump has been showering Netanyahu, lavishing him and his far-right extremist ministers with an enormous unprecedented gift bag from the moment he walked into office. Some of these gifts are under the pretext of bribing Netanyahu to agree to the ceasefire, but other elements in there have to do more with an extremist messianic pro-Israeli agenda. So for example, you have an U.S. immediate lifting of all sanctions on Israeli settlers and extremist groups that the Biden administration imposed. You also have an immediate process to sanction the International Criminal Court and collapse it because it dared to go after Israel. You have that visit to Washington that Biden was reluctant to extend to Netanyahu despite Biden's full complicity in the Gaza genocide. And you have other gift bags that are being showered on Smotrich and Ben-Gvir and Netanyahu to buy their complicity and silence.
I wanted to ask you about UNRWA. International staff working for the UN's main agency serving Palestinians have been forced to leave Israel after its ban on the agency came into effect. This is the deputy U.S. ambassador to the United. I want to go to the UNRWA spokesperson, Jonathan Fowler, who said Israel's decision could trigger a collapse of humanitarian aid to Palestinians.
We're responsible for over half of deliveries inside the Gaza Strip, over half of the aid coming in. You know, the UNRWA, I mean, has been described repeatedly, not by ourselves, but, you know, by others, as the backbone of the international aid operation, because the rest of the aid operation is just the UN presence is just a few hundred people. A few hundred does not equal 5,000. Without UNRWA being able to operate, there's a very real risk of the humanitarian operation collapsing.
So this is extremely significant, Mohammed. UNRWA out. As all the Palestinians are flooding into northern Gaza, if you can talk about both of these issues. Of course, UNRWA is larger than Gaza. It's serving millions of Palestinians throughout the Middle East.
Precisely. Well, UNRWA is Gaza's lifeline. If you take it out, this is a death sentence to Gaza's population. Since the ceasefire was enacted, my inbox has been flooded with messages from colleagues, from family members, from friends and loved ones who are literally begging to help to find them any place to stay, to help to even find a tent in northern Gaza, to help to find food to put on the table. If you take UNRWA away, it gets only way worse than this. Whatever rudimentary basic level of survival that is sustained in Gaza now with the little aid that's coming in, a lot of it is going to be explicitly banned by Israel because the Israeli legislation, it bans any imports to Gaza with UNRWA's label on it, as well as dismantling UNRWA's network. Also in Lebanon, for example, where Palestinians are living in refugee camps in abysmal conditions, UNRWA is a vital lifeline there. But it's not only a matter of service provider. UNRWA has played a transformative role for many Palestinians. My own father, whose family were kicked out in 48 by Israel to a refugee camp, the Shatil refugee camp in Gaza, he would have been a barefoot child with no life, with no income, with no purpose, if it wasn't for, in part, for UNRWA providing the infrastructure for education that brought him up as the doctor that I was very proud of until his death because of Israel's blockade. I myself wouldn't be standing in front of you now and speaking English and even knowing about politics or the history of the conflict or the history of the Holocaust if it was not for my UNRWA educational system. I would have not had an educational opportunity. So if you take all of that away from Gazans, it falls into Israel's plan to prevent any capacity in Gaza to maintain organized human life so that people would have to leave, so that Gaza is being emptied out completely. And that's the main concern.
And Mohammed, finally, if you could talk about the continuing Israeli assault in the West Bank, in particular on Jenin.
So basically, part of the gift bag that Netanyahu gave to his extremist minister, Bezalel Smotrich, to agree to the ceasefire in Gaza was to extend the war goals under the radar quietly to include the West Bank. So now the West Bank, from Israel's perspective, is a war zone. So that's why you have, for example, Israeli checkpoints booming and skyrocketing all across the West Bank, despite the IDF chief of staff, who is a settler himself, Herzi Halevi. He is not a pro-Palestinian left-wing, but that IDF chief of staff, he warned Netanyahu and Smotrich. He said, don't put these checkpoints. It will lead and push Palestinians to take to arms, to armed resistance, to resist Israel's occupation. But Netanyahu overruled him. In Jenin, you have a way worse dynamic than the rest of the West Bank, where Israel is trying to turn it into a clone of Gaza, ethnic cleansing, pushing people out and destroying homes systematically one after the other. All of it is to explode the West Bank, to use it as a pretext for a major war to push Palestinians out. That's the agenda of Israel's extremist ministers at the moment.
Mohammed Shahada, we thank you so much for being with us, writer and analyst from Gaza, chief of communications at Euro.
It was down in Chinatown, all the cookies laid around. Some were high and some were mighty low. There were millions on the floor when a knock came on the door, and there stood old Smokey Joe. He was wet and cold and pale, he was looking for his frail. He was broken, all his junk ran out. Nobody made a sound as he stood and looked around, and then you'd hear old Smokey shout, tell me where is Minnie?
Tell me where is Minnie?
My poor Minnie.
Your poor Minnie.
Has she been here kicking?
KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201 DA King Coast.